This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
This episode of Herding Code is brought to you by JetBrains. Their code coverage tool for .NET apps and Silverlight, .cover, will soon get an update with improved filtering, reporting, and presentation of unit test coverage results. Get a 30-day trial and a fair price at jetbrains.com/.cover. By the way, buying .cover entitles you to a full year of free upgrades. Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on February 16th, 2011. And there are a few things we haven't done for a while. One is have failed recordings at the beginning of the call. And so I've done that, and this is actually take three, which is so fun. Also, we haven't just sat around and talked about random things. So that's what we're doing. We're going to jump right into it with the Apple Store 30% fee thing. Now, as I skimmed the news, which is all I do these days, and read the tweets, it looked like the idea is that if I am buying anything through an iOS platform device, 30% goes to Apple. So that really affects things like Kindle books or other subscriptions or purchases. And does that sound right?
No, that is okay. Incorrect. So here's my understanding from this TechCrunch article, which is quoting Steve Jobs. It says, our philosophy is simple. When Apple brings a new subscriber to the app, Apple earns 30% share. When the publisher brings an existing or new subscriber to the app, the publisher keeps 100% and Apple earns nothing. All we require is that if a publisher is making a subscription offer outside of the app, the same or better offer be made inside the app. So they summarize it in this TechCrunch post.
If by summarized you mean it's like three pages with a bunch of pictures of Matt Damon.
And Oreos. Yes. For some reason. So there are two different issues which people are complaining about with Apple. The first one is that you have to be able to buy, your app has to allow people to buy content through the app itself, not outside. So apps like Kindle and Nook, if you want to buy a book, you click on the shop link or whatever, and it opens up a mobile Safari instance and takes you to the online Kindle store or Barnes & Noble Nook Book store. And there you buy the app, and then it syncs down to you buy the book, in other words, and what I mean. And then it syncs down to your Nook or Kindle app. And what Apple is saying is that if you're going to do that, you also have to allow the user to buy the app through, or buy a book through the app. And I think in that case, then Apple does take a little bit off the top, but I don't know if it's 30%. The only time I've heard the 30% has been applied towards subscriptions. But I haven't read the terms of service, and Kevin may know better than I.
Yeah, 30%. It doesn't matter.
So any kind of premium content through the app is they take a 30% cut off of whatever. Okay.
Okay. So I saw Nathan Bowers. His tweet was like that. This is not like protection money or being squeezed by the mafia. This is kind of like you're paying for rent for a nice store on Rodeo Drive. Do you guys agree with that? I mean, from how you're describing this, it's a little bit like if I'm bringing in new subscribers based on, because somebody's has an iPhone, iPad or whatever, that Apple says, yeah, we brought you a new customer, so we get a cut.
Mm. Yeah, except in what regard are they bringing them a customer? I mean, they may not be bringing them a customer at all. They're just providing a different channel. I just think it's a preposterous and greedy move on their part. I mean, I don't see how companies like Amazon or, this also affects people, potentially affects people like Pandora and Netflix and what's that other, Rhapsody, streaming music. So, mm-hmm. These are companies that there's no way they can afford to pay 30%. So the result will probably be that they leave the App Store and they basically have to pull their app is my guess is what's going to happen. And that's pretty shitty.
So one of the things I've heard
is considerable.
Yeah.
Yeah. I miss Amazon. They're not making that much, margin on a book.
It's not like Apple's paying for the bandwidth or anything like that. Credit card companies that skim a little bit just to keep the infrastructure around so that civilization doesn't implode. They're taking like 3%, 2%, 1%, right?
Well, I've heard anywhere from 5 to 9% for Discover, but people complain about that when you try to pay with Discover sometimes. But I think that is their not necessarily their primary goal, but one of the reasons they're using is that by providing the in-app payment system, they've got infrastructure they got to pay for. That's why they're taking a cut, and it provides a better experience for the user, being able to just click things with one touch, which it never is one touch. It's actually easier to buy a Kindle book through the Kindle app or through the Kindle website than it is to buy anything through an iOS app, because you always have to click it, and then it'll pop up a dialogue and say, are you sure you want to buy this? And you say buy. Then you have to enter your iTunes password. At least this is what I always have to do. Maybe other people have things set up differently. Then you enter your iTunes password, and then it comes up and it says, thank you, you have purchased this. And you have to dismiss that dialogue too. So there's like three touches you have to do at least to buy anything.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I don't know. I feel less surprised about this. I mean, and I don't want to sound like, you know, Apple bash, whatever, but I just have always...
It's like nothing surprises you anymore about
I mean, I really just kind of see it as something where Apple's got, they sell, you know, premium devices. They have a lot of, you know, the majority of the market for these. And so they're going to get as much money as they can. And in a way, it's kind of their, you know, they'd see it as kind of their responsibility to shareholders to get as much money out of these devices as they're selling. And so there's a point of what's cool and what's not cool, and a little bit as to, you know, what they can get away with. And maybe until there's more competition there, they, you know, like, why not charge what they can? I mean, I don't say that to be, you know, like, oh, they're a bunch of jerks. I'm just thinking from a shareholder value perspective. That's maybe what they're looking at is like, look, we've sold these devices. We can monetize the X percent and we'll lose, you know, some of the apps, but we'll end up breaking even or making more or whatever.
Well, it's like the electronics in the computer stores. They don't make the margin on the PCs. They make the margins on the cables and the profits. That's kind of what Apple is doing here. So, you know, they're not. They're making money, obviously, off their iPhone, but yeah, they're just looking to make a little bit of margin on, you know, the cables or in-app purchases and junk like that. So I've kind of seen two different ways that I think this could go. One, either Kindle and Barnes & Noble, because, you know, you can try to push around Amazon, I guess, if you're Apple. But Barnes & Noble has been around for a long time. They have a lot of brick-and-mortar stores, and they make a lot of money for a lot of really large publishers, who are also trying to, you know, publish and sell things maybe through iBooks. And so I'm wondering if, you know, Barnes & Noble won't, you know, leverage some of that relationship with big publishers to kind of, you know, get Apple to ease up a little bit on that. And if they don't do that, or if that doesn't work, if they just go ahead and put the in-app purchasing in, because, you know, what do they care? they'll just raise rates on the e-books to offset the loss. I think that Amazon, since they've already announced a web-based reader and for Kindle books, and I don't know if you guys have ever browsed Amazon Mobile on a like an Android and iOS device, they have a really, really good mobile experience in terms of, you know, just going straight web. I wouldn't be surprised if they, you know, did pull their app but say, hey, we've got an iOS-optimized Kindle reader that you can just go to and you don't have to worry about anything. It'll just work just like the old app did.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's exactly what's going to end up happening if, you know, if Apple doesn't back down on this, that these services like Netflix and Pandora and Amazon or Kindle will move to the web.
Now, that was originally kind of the Jobs plan anyhow there, wasn't it? I mean, it was like, look, it's there wasn't going to be an app store and everything was going to be, you know, HTML5 web apps.
I think that was all.
Yeah, I've thought that too.
They just didn't have the SDK and App Store ready at launch.
Okay, you know, that's what I always thought, that, and that I've been hearing this more lately enough that I was starting to believe it. So you set me straight.
Because, you know, for the longest time, he said people don't want video on their iPods too. Mm-hmm. And then looky.
Well, I'm wondering if, like, do they care? Like, at what point do they care? I guess they would care at a point where it's less of a selling point, where you need to buy an iPad so that you can get a Kindle. You know, like, people are just going to say, well, I'll buy an Android device and run Kindle on it or whatever.
Or they'll just say, I'll buy a Kindle.
Yeah, there's that.
See, well, I got to tell you, because I got a Kindle this year, and one of my favorite features of the Kindle is not the Kindle. It's the fact that I can read on my iOS device. Mm. It is, that is, and I didn't really anticipate that when I got the Kindle. I didn't think about that side benefit, but wherever I am, I can read a few pages of my book, and it syncs, you know, where, what my current read location is across the devices. It's a totally killer feature for me.
Yeah, that's...
So, yeah, I'm kind of bitter that if, you know, Apple's talking about essentially taking that away.
It's the same experience with the Nook app and the Nook Reader, too. Yeah, you just... You pick it up, you're somewhere, you read a few pages, click the bookmark, it syncs it across, and you pick it up when you pick up your reader. And that's why I think that, you know... Maybe Amazon won't be able to leverage it, because we already know they've caved to the publishers. But I think Barnes & Noble might be able to push that a little bit. Or they might just pull their app altogether, because what do they care? They've got a platform.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not like, you know, not like they're totally invested in the online, you know, the iOS app, I guess, necessarily. Because they've got a reader that's an Android tablet. They've got a regular reader to compete with a Kindle. And they've got brick-and-mortar stores, which are profitable, unlike poor Borders books.
Yeah, but you know,
poor Borders.
You know, as you mentioned Nook too, it's interesting because I've been reading that the Nook has been rooted, and people are running Android on that, and then running the Kindle app on Nook, which is kind of funny.
Yep.
So
yeah, and that was one of the things I wondered about, because they're gonna eventually have an app store for the Nook Color, is my understanding. And they already have an SDK out, which is basically just an Android SDK with a special, you know, bigger emulator that emulates the Nook Color. And I'd wondered if there was going to be a Kindle app for it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just an Android device. So in theory, if they let you install any app, you know, sideload any kind of Android app, you could run the Kindle app for Android on there. Hmm. I don't know.
One thing that kind of feels crappy about this whole thing is that it kind of feels like, you know, Apple was getting their ass handed to them on iBooks by Amazon. You know, Kindle was just kicking butt over iBooks, and so they had to like figure out a way to change the game. It has that sort of feel to it, you know, and that's just really weasely.
Do you think it'll work? Like, I haven't heard anything about iBooks since it was announced. I mean, do you think that this is enough where people will be like, oh, all right, fine, I'll just, you know, run iBooks?
No.
Hmm.
I think that you know, if we assume worst case that Apple doesn't cave and Amazon doesn't cave and they pull the Kindle app, people will just use their Kindle, and they just won't use their iPad or iPhone or iPod to read Kindle books anymore. And they'll grumble and complain, but they'll keep on using it.
I do think that this kind of stuff, though, does put a lot of fear into application developers. You know, that this notion has happened before, that Apple could pull the rug out from under them at any time. And you do have to wonder whether, you know, at some point people are just not going to put up with it anymore and are going to do like what the 37 Signals guys did, which was, you know, when they came out with their Basecamp mobile stuff, they did it all as HTML5. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, forget this, you know, native stuff.
First they came for Kindle and no one spoke up. Then they came for Netflix and no one spoke up. And then they came for me. Oh, wait. Did I just Godwin this whole thing?
Well, I do wonder about that. You know, there's the common thing I keep hearing is that, you know, people need to build native apps because they're going to look right and feel right and all that. But when it comes down to the point of if the app developer is paying 30% versus able to, you know what I mean, able to write a cross-platform app and not pay any additional things, you know, any additional fees, I wouldn't be surprised to see more of this stuff move to the HTML app world. And then you get all the benefits of not having to learn different, you know, graphics platforms and different memory management systems and how to optimize your GPU and all that fun stuff.
Well, wow. You actually don't have to optimize the GPU on iOS.
Right? True.
But yeah, and, you know, so stuff like Netflix would be a little harder to pull off, given the investment that they kind of have in the app and the streaming to the app. But, you know, certainly they could stream, you know, MP4s or whatever to, you know, through HTML, through a video element or something. Mm-hmm. But the book readers are almost a no-brainer. It's just layout.
Yeah. It's text, which the World Wide Web was...
With occasionally an image tag, yeah.
That's actually what the World Wide Web was kind of designed for a change.
Well, the one thing about books is the storage issue. You know, when you've got the, you know, the Kindle app downloads the book to your phone and you can read it on the plane and whatever.
But I mean, that could be offline storage too.
Maybe you could do it all through offline storage.
Should we move on?
Next topic. All right,
next topic. Windows Mobile makes this surprise, maybe not such a big surprise, deal with Nokia. Nokia ditches their platform and is moving to Windows Mobile over the next year, I guess. Think it'll help?
I think they're both pretty late. I mean, on the surface, it looks pretty interesting, but then there's so many parallels between what happened here. You had Nokia investing so much time in a platform that wasn't a smartphone, where their CEO basically wrote a letter to the company that said, that made the analogy of the company standing on top of a burning oil rig. I think that was something like that. So it was basically, you know, we have to do something or we're finished. And Microsoft, pretty much the same way. I mean, they should have had a better mobile platform 3 years ago. And whether it's because they just were still investing so much in the desktop OS and Office and their traditional line of business stuff and not looking forward, I don't know. But you sort of have these two companies that are both trying to play catch up. So it's still going to be at least another year, I think, until anything comes of this.
I think that Nokia has a lot of goodwill, though, still in the kind of the mobile phone community, because they made a lot of really good phones for a long time. They kind of made some cheap, you know, cheap ones too, but they were huge.
But does anyone care?
The whole smartphone and BlackBerry.
I wonder if anyone really cares, though, because people get a new phone every couple of years. So I find that I personally feel a lot less loyalty. Like when I go shopping for a phone, I'm kind of going shopping for, you know, a whole new. I realize when you're bought in with apps that it's a little bit more to leave a platform behind. But I wonder if there's less kind of feeling of investment from customers because of this 2 year upgrade cycle or whatever it is.
Well, see, that we haven't really seen that kind of behavior with the new smartphone kind of platforms. Before, that was the case because in 2 years, your carrier didn't have your phone anymore. And, you know, and they had some new feature that, you know, your phone didn't have, and so you had to get it. And so I'm wondering if people are really going to start, you know, if there's going to be a lot of turnover, I guess. People will get, you know, drop their iPhone 3 and get the iPhone 4. They're still on iPhone. They're not jumping and saying, oh, well, now I'm going to get an Android, which was the case before. You know, there was no common kind of thread until BlackBerry came along. And then, and then it didn't really matter which BlackBerry you got because you didn't have really apps for it or anything. You were just using it to get your email and texting. But now that you've got, yeah, like you said, like you've got investment in apps and you've got investment in learning the platform.
And all those fun cables.
Yes. And, you know, hey, I've got this cable that only fits my iPhone now.
I wonder too, you know, like, okay, so like you're saying, the investment that people have, there's the consumer investment, and then there's also the platform or the corporate investment. And so, you know, by Nokia switching from Symbian to Windows Phone, it's, you know, I would think, you know, maybe some corporations or people would say, I've always owned Nokia, I'm going to buy the next Nokia phone. But it is different, you know. I mean, it's a completely new platform now.
Well, that's kind of my thinking is that they have a good track record for making good phones. So the thinking is that people will be more likely to give a Windows phone a look if it's made by Nokia, maybe, than just one by Samsung or HTC. Mm. HTC isn't, you know, really a worldwide brand name, but Nokia, yeah. They've been making cell phones for, you know, decades.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like a Motorola Win 7 phone. Do they have those?
I don't think so.
Motorola cashed in its chips with the Droid,
yeah,
didn't it?
Yeah. Which actually worked pretty well for them to buy into a new platform, and they were able to kind of I think I remember reading that they kind of revolutionized their, you know, they were seen as a has-been smartphone developer, and they kind of restarted that.
I think it was pretty clear that Nokia had to do something drastic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the last 10 years, at least in the U.S., I'm sure it's different in other parts of the world, but, you know, Nokia hasn't even been on my radar as a viable,
mm-hmm,
you know, phone option in the last 10 years.
I think I read where they were concentrating a lot in emerging markets, where I'm not even sure that even when they have a smartphone running Windows Mobile, if it's going to be selling into places like that.
Hmm.
But I did pull the statistic up here where they're the global smartphone market Symbian, they dropped, and I don't know how they define a smartphone here, but they're saying Nokia had a, Symbian had a 46.9% market share in 2009, and it dropped to 37.6% in 2010. So that's pretty significant.
I wonder how all this affects, you know, the corporate phone world where they actually are using like corporate apps. Like for instance, there was the Windows CE, or what was it? Windows Mobile, up through Windows Mobile 6.5. And I remember like they were the folks that were really up in arms when Microsoft said, hey, we're coming out with a new phone platform. And, you know, it's like, hey, finally, this is going to be something that consumers like. And the one group that was very upset about that was all these corporate folks that were like, look, we've got our apps, you know, our custom apps. And that's one thing that, like the Windows phone currently doesn't really have all that enterprise feature support. It's a consumer phone.
Yeah, all those IT people who want to make your phone just as unusable as your desktop. Those are the people who are complaining the most.
Right. So I wonder where this leaves them then, because, you know, Windows Phone probably over time will add in more of those enterprise features. iPhone is not really an enterprise phone at all, I don't think, right? And then with Nokia moving from Symbian, I mean, I guess the last kind of corporate phone then is the BlackBerry. I don't even know if there are corporate BlackBerry apps. And apparently no one else does either.
I don't know. You know, I have zero experience with BlackBerry. I've never had one.
I have one for work, but I think we did release an Edge client. Edge is our like firewall app. We did have an Edge client for it, I think. But, you know, that's kind of our bread and butter, F5, so of course we're going to release one for it. I haven't heard much about BlackBerry enterprise development. Most people just, you know, it's a business phone. It's the texting and email in the enterprise.
Yeah, I always thought it was a big mistake that Microsoft targeted Windows Phone as a consumer phone. I think they really should have gone after the enterprise market to start with. That's their bread and butter. That's the market that Microsoft knows the best.
Well, I mean, it always kind of was in terms of, I mean, it had the features, it had the development support stuff the criticism I've heard is the reason that Windows Phone strategy always looked so crazy was because they were listening to, you know, corporate requests more than consumers. Like how do you, Kevin, when you say that, how do you think that they should have?
Well, like, you know, it should be hands down the best Exchange client, you know, out there. And I haven't used one, but I've, you know, heard.
Why would you assume that when Outlook isn't hands down the best Exchange client out there?
Outlook is another matter. You know, it should have all the IT policies stuff that people want. You know, it should have, you know, it's got some of the development tooling stuff, you know, with the Silverlight stuff. But, you know, they did all this Facebook integration stuff, which, you know, is totally consumer centric. I'm not saying they shouldn't go after the consumer market. I'm just saying as their entry point, I think it made more sense to target, you know, their bread and butter customer base.
I think, and maybe that's true. I don't know over time if people, like, it used to be that you got your phone, like that a mobile phone was something you got through your work only. And now I think that it's just kind of more common where people are using their cell phones as part of their daily life. They're getting their email, they're running apps and stuff like that. And so maybe selling directly to the consumer. I don't know. Well, interesting. Should we move on?
Next topic,
Reflektor. So Reflektor went from originally Let's Rotor wrote it. It was a, everyone knows what Reflektor is. Great decompiling, or I guess disassembling application. But it was never an open source application. It was always a freeware app. And I think in 2008, he sold it to Redgate Software. And Redgate Software made a, I don't know. Now it depends now. It seems like it's been rewritten a bit, but they made kind of a pledge that they were going to try and keep it as a free community tool and then sell additional add-ons. And they had additional add-ons which looked kind of neat, like it would let you debug. There was a Visual Studio plugin that would let you, you know, I guess debug into reflected code and stuff like that. But apparently not enough people bought it. They said that they're discontinuing the free product. It's going to be pay only. And I guess the things that are more irritating to people are, one, that it was that they made this kind of pledge that they weren't going to do that, and two, that the app always phones home and checks for updates, and so they're going to like remotely, they're just going to disable the old client that was free. So if you downloaded it last week, it's going to stop working. So what do you guys think? Evil? Fact of life?
Well, shitty. I mean, yeah, really, really bad from a community perspective, obviously. I mean, Reflector is second only to Visual Studio as the most valuable tool in the developer's arsenal on the .NET platform, at least for me. And so it's a epically bad move from a community perspective. I mean, whether or not it's a good business move, I think they're certainly going to piss off a whole lot of people.
Mm-hmm. That's what baffles me. It's their product. They can do what they want with it. But Redgate seemed to be one of those companies that was in touch with the community. They're always trying to reach out to user groups and MVPs and give out free samples to people. And then, you know, to pull this and have a big firestorm start in the community was, I think, the most surprising aspect of it all.
It seemed to a little bit like just like, hey, we're sorry, but this is how it is. I wondered if there'd been a little bit more of a, it could have been handled better, even if they were kind of pretty sure that's what was going to happen. But if they just said, look, nobody's buying this, we're going to have to discontinue this. It just seemed like more of it was just like, here's an announcement. This is what we're doing. And I think some of that felt like it was, I don't know.
The thing that gets me too is, first of all, for 7 years, 8 years, this was a tool that was written by one guy maintaining his spare time. Like, how can they not, you know, how many developers do they have working on this thing that they can't get something out of that? Unless, you know, Lutz is just a super genius. And the other thing is, Reflector essentially needs no new features, as far as I'm concerned. Like, aside from new versions of the .NET framework, you know, like adding dynamic support and stuff, Reflector has essentially not needed to change in the last 6 years.
Right.
So what the heck, you know, how many development resources are they pouring into this thing that they can't make that work?
I wondered about, I mean, and maybe it's something where that's more difficult than you'd think to add in support for things like dynamic and but yeah, I do.
Iterators. it would be nice if they decompiled iterators a little better, but.
Yeah, I do wonder about that, especially too. There's a plugin model, so you know, like there's.
Yeah, I wrote a plugin for that, and that also was kind of annoying.
It does seem like something where it could have been like the division of what was free and what was paid could be different. I do think that, you know, the whole idea of what was going to be sold, like I don't know what the plan was of what they were going to sell, like how they were going to make money with this. Was it that the Visual Studio add-in was just going to tons of people would buy it? No, it's clear.
Right. It kind of feels like what happened is they, you know, they bought it. They said, okay, we're gonna pour a ton of resources onto this thing and we're going to add all these new features. And then they realized, oh, we can't actually generate enough revenue to support all those developers working on this thing. So instead of, you know, cutting the resources they were applying it to it, they went the other way.
Right.
And you know, took away the free product.
So as an aside here, I mentioned on Twitter how it was a very valuable tool to me that I use it all the time. And somebody said, why? Like, what do you need it for? Why do you need, are you really concerned about performance where you're digging into things and trying to see? And, I mean, I mostly use it to like explore a DLL or a framework that, you know, that I just need to understand like how it's working for understanding something like, for instance, entity framework. What is this thing doing? How is it generating this, you know, like how is entity framework code first actually working and figuring, you know, like assigning things. And I've used it for MVC waiting for the source code to ship sometimes. And even once the code's shipped, it's easier to navigate than loading it up as a solution.
That's what I was going to say. Even when you have the source code to something, it was often easier to go into a Reflector and just search for a type and start clicking around and get somewhere with it.
Yeah, it's really fast.
Yeah, it is. It is what the object browser in Visual Studio always should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Object browser is a pale pretender. Like even if it didn't do the decompilation stuff, it would still be valuable to me.
Mm-hmm.
I've found like the decompilation thing is interesting too, in order to be to decompile to different languages. So like you can decompile, especially with plugins, I think you can decompile to like PowerShell, or, you know, one time I wrote a console app and decompiled it to MSIL just to like get a better understanding, you know, of what was going on, or F sharp. So, I mean, that kind of cross compiling feature is pretty slick. You mentioned, Kevin, the object browser, which interestingly, I think MonoDevelop and possibly SharpDevelop both have like reflector-like features as their object browser. So, and that came up as, you know, as soon as this was, as they said, this is going to be a four-pay project, then people, or this is going to cost money, then people said, well, is there an open source application out there like this? And so there's a few out there. Have you guys tried any?
I have not yet.
I tried one. It was like IL something or other. It was the one that came from the SharpDevelop project.
IL Spy.
Yes. Then there's also the Mono one, and that one is by it uses the Cecil library. And there was something announced when Reflector, the day that there was a Reflector announcement, there was something that came out that said, stand by, there's going to be some big new announcement coming up soon. And that's the last day.
JetBrains.
There's also JetBrains.
JetBrains posted JetBrains little teaser.
Right. Well, now that's on top of what I also heard from the Mono disassembler. They said they were going to make some big announcement too. But yeah, so the JetBrains, all we saw was a screenshot, and it looked like it was a decompile, like you search for some code and it decompiles it in place, which is neat, but it doesn't have the same
navigation.
Yeah. But it does have a CSS color picker coming up,
so that's nice.
Yeah, and that's the great irony, is that essentially I think Redgate has shot themselves in the foot here, because they're forcing the open source community to step up and write a replacement, and that's exactly what they're doing,
which ironically enough will lower their support costs because no one will be using theirs anymore.
Actually, when I first heard the announcement that Lutz had sold it to Redgate, I tweeted that inside of a year I expected that there would be an open source version of this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, we're not talking a king's ransom here. What is it? $35?
Yeah,
and people will pay $195, $235 for Code Rush or ReSharper, but you know, they won't pay $35 for Reflector.
It's not even the money to me. It's the, you know, the purchasing in a corporation is a royal pain. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to get approval
forms.
And yeah, you need to fill out your TPS forms in triplicate, and you got to manage licenses. It's just a whole level of friction that is just, you know.
Well, that's why it's $35. So, you know, that's enough you could spring for a personal license and just use it.
You know, I think a
and I have to worry about it the rest of that.
I think a bigger concern for me is over the years, whenever I've bought, like, it's true, $35 is not that much, but when it's a product that you're paying money for or it's freeware, it can be discontinued at any time. And so maybe not enough people buy it at $35. Does it just go away? And it definitely could. I mean, I've used a lot of apps that just, they stopped releasing new versions, or, you know what I mean? And so I think that's the bigger feature for me as an open source app, is more likely to, if a lot of people are actually really using it, that it's more likely to live on. So, I mean, that's just from a personal, like, where I want to invest my time learning products and what I want to get used to installing and all that. I've gone more to open source apps, mostly just because it's like, I'm not as worried about the, like, just buying or hey, here's a cool freeware app, and then like it just, there's no, you know, it's like refresh the page, still no new version, you know.
Well, so one of the big problems or complaints I heard about the ReSharper wasn't the ReSharper itself, it was the VS add-in. So people were trying to use the VS add-in, but it kept crashing their Visual Studio instance. And so one of the things that I commented when they announced it was, yeah, sure, I'll pay $35 for it, but I'm also going to raise my expectations around what, you know, the Reflector and the add-in will do and how they'll work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the Reflector has always been, you know, kind of nice, but, you know, it's kind of ugly. And yeah, the navigation as far as clicking through and going back, you know, the back button's amazing. I use that constantly because I forget where I came from and want to go back to where I was when I was looking at that type. But you know, it when it's free, you look at that kind of stuff and you're like, yeah, okay, that's fine. But you know, when you're paying for it, now you start to think, well, you know, maybe the search should be a little bit better. Right. Maybe, you know, I should be able to, you know, search and narrow it down by namespace, or maybe I want a better visualization of the inheritance of the classes, mm-hmm. or, you know, that's when you start looking at it, like, well, if they're making money off of it, or if they're charging for it, then it should be, you know, better. So kind of doing the same thing, like Kevin had said, they haven't really added any new features to Reflector in the longest time, mm-hmm. because, you know, what are you really going to add? But now suddenly, if you're paying for it, you start to think, well, what should they add? Yeah. What do I not like about this? It needs to have a Twitter plugin, mm-hmm. obviously, and it needs to be able to read email.
Yeah.
Because all apps have to do those two things.
And an ebook right. reader.
I've thought over time I'd be willing to pay just to shut off the check for updates, because that is so annoying, especially like if you don't have internet access and you try and start up Reflector and it's like, nope, sorry, you need to check for updates.
Yeah, and more than once it has deleted itself as part of the update process and not installed the new version. Have you ever had that?
No,
happen?
I never had that. Yeah.
It's like, updating, bye-bye, poof.
Oh, man.
Yeah, now when it's free... Oh, that wacky Reflector.
Yeah.
I'll go enter yet another bogus email address and download mm-hmm. it. But $35, you're like, hey, now I got to call support. Right. Got to get on the phone and relicense or whatever. And I got to look up my product key and re-enter it when I reinstall it.
Right. And then you wonder if it's $35 for a license going to cover the average support and key support and all that kind of stuff over time. I mean, you know what I mean? The costs do go up. For selling software versus giving it away. All right. Should we move on?
Next topic.
Next topic. We've got, so I just skimmed the release post, but we had Mono 2.10 and Moonlight 4 preview announcement post from Miguel today, which was cool. I always like his, especially like the Moonlight post. He had a lot of graphics in there about diagrams about how they were, you know, had optimized things and were optimizing the graphics rendering and neat stuff. Mono 2.10, I guess one thing that was neat in there was the MVC3 support, which is cool because MVC3 came out like a month ago.
They're slowing down.
Any thoughts? Anything interesting there?
Awesome. Iron Ruby and Iron Python.
That's cool. Yep. So that was part of the... part of the thing, those being open source and transitioned over. So that's cool that they're included in there.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that the guy who worked on Compiz joined the Moonlight team. Holy
yeah,
cow.
That's huge, huh?
You guys know what Compiz mm-hmm. is? That lets you do the little spinning cube when you switch desktops in Ubuntu or any Linux distro that's got the GPU support? Wow. That guy is he's one of them graphics whizzes.
So I wondered that as, you know, I was seeing all this neat stuff that they're doing as far as GPU acceleration. And then there had been that Twitter conversation we were watching between Kelly Summers, previous guest on the show, and Pete Brown, awesome guy who happens to be my boss. So I will only say nice things about him. But who also, actually, that'd be neat to get him on the show sometime. But he
hasn't been on the show?
Yeah, kind of crazy, huh?
Well, now if you have an on,
I know it'll be awkward. Yeah. But so they were talking about, you know, Windows Phone and Silverlight performance and scrolling and stuff like that. And I wonder, you know, like at least from all these diagrams on the Moonlight release, it makes it look like it's going to be really neat because the Compiz thing, I mean, it's a cube. I don't know. he has a way of like all his posts talk like the sell the technology in a way that makes me go like, this is going to be the best ever. And then, you know, like, I don't know technically. I don't know really if it is, but it just looks really neat.
Well, so the big summary from the Kelly and Pete conversation, I guess, was that WPF and Silverlight don't use the GPU efficiently enough. So there's performance issues with certain controls. I think what she talked about, a scrolling list, mm-hmm. I think that scrolls really slow. Or slow enough, at least on the phone, that it, you know, looks kind of, it gives you an odd effect when you're, you know, used to, if you're coming from the iPhone or iOS where, you know, you just flick your thumb and the thing just kind of rolls on very, very smoothly and quickly, kind of no matter how big the list is. I guess there's enough jitter on Windows Phone 7 that it's an awkward user experience.
My guess on that is that from playing just briefly with one is that the actual like native apps, the home screen and stuff, scroll pretty smoothly. And so I'm wondering if it's, you know, like the native apps, you know, and XNA stuff is really smooth, and then the Silverlight dev stack is slower.
Well, that was her point, that the Silverlight and WPF in general just have, you know, don't use the GPU efficiently. And it looks like from this post that Moonlight would kick Silverlight's ass.
We'll see. Then we're back to the cubes and the diagrams.
Web matrix.
Well, he mentions shaders, too.
That's true.
Shaders are something else complicated.
Now, did he mention that shaders are GPU accelerated? Because as the last I was messing with this stuff, shaders and Silverlight were not GPU accelerated. They're software accelerated. And I believe that at the time that I read that, it was an intentional decision because shaders are like it's possible to write malware using shaders because it's a programming language and you can do some pretty tough stuff that's difficult to detect.
So the shader effect allows users to load pixel shaders written using the high-level shader language. So he's not really saying, I guess it's probably up to the graphic driver how shaders are implemented.
But. Yeah, I'm interested.
John, I like that, software accelerated. I'm going to start using that to describe my products. It's software accelerated.
Yeah, nice. So also in Mono 2.10 is, Kay Scott, you were mentioning the support for webmatrix.data and also Razor and web pages. So that's pretty quick support there. That's kind of cool. Maybe that'll make Rob Connery happy.
You can use the C# REPL to run C# scripts. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So back to the GPU acceleration, it says the rendering pipeline was modified. Now whenever a UI element has either a projection or effect or has the flag bitmap cache set, the entire UI element and its children are rendered into a surface that is then offloaded for the GPU to render. When OpenGL is available on the system, the composition of UI and elements is entirely done by the GPU. So that's kind of, I think, what I was saying. That it depends on... Oh, and Moonlight will use the GPU to accelerate for compositing, perspective transformations, and pixel shaders if the hardware is present without having to turn this on.
Okay.
Silverlight, by default, requires developers to opt into hardware acceleration and has its own set of features that it will hardware accelerate. So to summarize all that, Moonlight will kick Silverlight's ass in terms of hardware acceleration.
I think we need to do a Herding Code episode where all we do is read me files from various projects.
No, this is a blog post.
This is, yeah.
Should we move on?
Next. No, I've got more to
read.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
Watson.
Okay.
So apparently IBM.
Yeah, I hate that guy. I'm never sure where my error reports are going.
Right. He just pops up and he's like I thought Dr. Watson.
But he's a doctor. So.
And he's holding a stethoscope, but the Dr. Watson.
You trust him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So apparently IBM still does computers. First of all, IBM is still around and they make computers. And
really big ones.
And this one is has beaten somebody in Jeopardy.
Apparently,
well,
IBM.
Go ahead.
Apparently, IBM has a whole game show and board game division. They make computers for chess. They make computers for Jeopardy. What's next? I'm waiting for the computer for Dancing with the Stars.
So, if I was an IBM shareholder, would I be happy about this?
Well, they made $52,000 on Jeopardy, so
okay.
You know.
All right.
People are around. You'll pay for
the machine. Cost $7 million to make.
So, and then the other question is, was it just calling back into Wolfram Alpha? Because that's what I would have done.
It did not. I do remember this question. I didn't actually watch any of the shows, but I read summaries because I read stuff on the web on shows sometimes too. Watson did not know that the city of Toronto was not a U.S. city.
Hmm.
So apparently it doesn't call into Google Maps or anything.
But. Yeah. I heard that it didn't have an internet connection at all.
I'd be screwed without that.
I know. It's
I thought it was just calling
poor machine.
Just running Bing. Searches on Bing the whole
right,
time.
Right.
Yeah. You guys make fun of it, but you'll be the first ones up against the wall when the AI revolution takes place.
So actually, I wasn't that impressed by a computer doing well at Jeopardy. Like, they would seem like this is just a store, you know, several encyclopedias. I mean, this is just a dictionary lookup kind of thing. I mean, you've got some parsing to, right, you know, to phrase your answer in the form of a question, I guess. But, you know, this doesn't seem like there's any strategy involved. This is just dictionary lookup.
Yeah, it seems like it's the language parsing that's the hard part, not the knowledge.
Hmm. All right.
Yeah.
So we could totally build that.
Right. Well, it does seem like, you know, yeah, okay, so there's...
I was hoping it would behave like Sean Connery on here.
That would be cool.
The rapist for 400, Alex.
I'll have to paste that in. Okay, let's move on. Let us talk about, CardSpace 2.0. I read a blog post yesterday that said CardSpace 2.0 would not be shipped. And apparently, I think I'm one of like three people in the world that actually like really thought CardSpace was awesome.
Should we have a moment of silence?
But then they said, in the grand spirit of reading blog posts, let me find this and then I will say it as if I knew it.
We might want to tell people what the hell CardSpace is, since nobody in the world actually knows. Right.
Okay. Yeah. So,
why are we talking about it?
It's the replacement for the solitaire game in Windows, right?
So, CardSpace, the idea, I think that the idea is awesome. And then I'll tell you why I thought it was awesome, and then I'll tell you why I don't think it worked. But the awesome idea is typing in passwords.
Is there anything for us to do here?
Yeah, you can ridicule me when I finish. Or as I go.
I wonder if Watson knows what CardSpace.
I'm guessing not. I like OpenID is a solution to identity management. Passwords suck. It's easy to lose your password, get your password compromised. OpenID is a way of trying to solve that by somebody else vouching for me. And so I only have one password and I keep it at one place where I think that people know what they're doing. So I keep it at Google instead of, you know, Wacky Bob's Twitter service that may or may not steal my password. So that's an improvement, but there's still problems with OpenID, one being that it's still going over HTTP, it's still internet forum posts, and so, you know, maybe not completely secure, could be spoofed. Also, OpenID and OpenAuth, you kind of just say, use my identity to vouch for me. But you can't say, look, I'm just logging onto Twitter, you don't need my credit card. Or, you know what I'm saying? So there's a limitation, and because of that, nobody, like all these OpenID providers, don't store credit cards. They don't store any kind of information other than your email address, really, because that's all people want to give out. So the idea with, first it was called InfoCard, and then it was renamed to CardSpace for no real reason I could understand, was that you would have these personal identity cards, and you could present them, and that you could have a self-signed one or you could get one from different places. And the two nice things are, one, you would only give the information that, so like I would go to my bank and it would say, I need your bank account. And so I would, it would pop up a dialogue. I would click my card that has my bank information, my financial information. It would just send my bank account number and be done. So I wouldn't be passing my Twitter account to my bank and I wouldn't pass my credit card to Twitter. And so that's kind of neat, like the directed identity thing. But then the other thing that really I thought was cool was that it was a separate UI outside of the browser. It would pop up another thing that would communicate separately. And so then you have the, you know, like it's less spoofable. It's the same way like UAC dialogue pops up, which I know is annoying, but it's a completely different like process running. So it's a lot more secure. So I thought all that was really cool. I think the whole card thing, people thought of that as like that there were smart cards, which you could use a smart card or you could use biometric stuff, but you could also just have a virtual card. I have probably put you guys all to sleep, which is part of the reason that I think none of this took off. But the other thing, reason I think none of this took off is because nobody ever supported it. So like I thought it was actually, it shipped in, I don't know, Vista or one of the service packs in Vista. And I said, awesome, installing it. Now where can I use it? And I could not, the only place I ever found that I could use an info card was my OpenID. So that was neat. Like I could log in via OpenID to any website I wanted to without ever typing in a password. But it was only one place, and it drove me nuts. Like, why can't I use CardSpace at like a Microsoft property? And did I lose Kevin? Hung up on me. Are you guys there? Okay, Scott.
Not if you're gonna keep talking about CardSpace.
Huh? Yeah. So where did I go wrong? Because that's as best as I can say why I think it's cool, but nobody cares, I guess, huh?
Well, it's like another one of those. It's none of those technologies you can't explain to anyone who doesn't already know about it.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same problem that OpenID has. So trying to explain to my wife or some of my non-technical friends that, you know, hey, you can just use your Yahoo account to sign into lots of different sites. They're like, but they're not Yahoo. It just doesn't register.
Right.
They don't get it. Kind of the same thing, you know, with CardSpace. And, you know, if I was to ask you, where do you go to manage your CardSpace in Windows? Could you tell me?
Yeah.
You could.
I would hit the window button and I would type CardSpace.
CardSpace. See, that's the only way you could do it.
Yeah. But yeah, and I think the bigger thing is like nobody cares about any kind of login if you can't use it anywhere. People, wow, we got a power outage from Kevin. Let me see if I can add him in without dropping the call.
Look, there it is. Select a card to preview. Add a card.
But the big problem, okay, good. So the big problem is there's nowhere to go with it. Like, it's a secure way. I can use it to log in. I mean, I guess maybe they went after corporate, you know, corporations and stuff, but like this would be a nice way to log into things. Like I had going through a bank, you know, refi, and like I tried to use their system and it was so absolutely ridiculous. They sent me passwords and PDF files and like I had to change my password and I mean just all that crazy stuff. And it was like I would have loved to use something like CardSpace for that, but you know, so I.
Or LastPass.com.
Well,
lots of people are starting to use stuff like LastPass and 1Password and Password Vault and other like in-browser online sites or you know, little tray apps to manage their passwords. Or they just use browsers, save password.
Yeah, which all that works, but then it's like then you have your password at work and at home and it's and on different computers and I don't know. I'm despondent over the whole identity thing. I mean, I guess it's going to just turn into log in with Facebook and log in with Google and eventually, you know, see where it goes.
Well, I've been using LastPass.com for a while now. Barry Dorans actually recommended it to me along with like 10 other people at the same time. And it works great. It doesn't store anything on their servers in an unencrypted manner. So it sends like your passwords down to you and then you decrypt it locally through a browser extension or a browser helper and IE. And then when you go to a site, it fills in your password.
How does that work on your phone?
I don't know. I haven't paid for the phone app yet, or I haven't paid for the premium subscription to use it on the phone yet.
I guess that's my big problem is like, if I use that, I can only ever use my computer. Like I can't use, you know, I can't use a computer at someone else's house or, you know, like that kind of thing.
Well, you can. You can go to the
website.
The site. Yeah. And you can view your passwords there if you want.
Well, so then there's also one, which is maybe where I will end up eventually. But the one other thing is on the post where they said CardSpace 2 wasn't going to be shipped. They said, you know, we're going to focus on some other things, you know, such as OpenID 2.0, OAuth Wrap, OAuth 2.0. I haven't really followed what all these are. But then one other thing that they mentioned was the release of UProve, which is something Microsoft bought from Credentica. And Credentica, I guess the idea is that it's more anonymous. So the website that you log into knows that you are who you say you are, but it never really knows any more information about you than what you give it. That's about all I could read about. Does anyone else know anything about this UProve thing? Yeah, I don't know.
No.
Should we go on? I guess it's just kind of something to keep an eye on. Maybe somebody can explain this. I think that it all comes down to people are going to use whatever they can to get to their email and go to sites like Facebook and Twitter. And it's kind of like porn drives hardware. It's, you know, it's like all this security stuff is just going to drive people getting to the sites and using the apps they want to do. And so at the end of the day, you know, it's going to have to be demand that pulls this. Cause I, you know, was thinking, wow, you know, Gawker, steals everyone's passwords. This is, people are going to really move now. No, nobody cares. They just change their password. No, it's a bummer, and you know, kind of go on. So, all right. So from there, how about a new topic?
New topic.
Internet Explorer 9 release candidate just came out. Is anyone using this besides me? No. I'm just going to make up features then.
I haven't installed it. I installed the beta for a while, and then I tried to install some piece of software and it wouldn't work with IE9.
That's weird.
I can't remember what it was, but it was, it might've been Quicken that I was trying to install and it wouldn't. And it was the weirdest thing because it specifically wouldn't work with IE9. If you want to install it, it worked with IE8. But it wasn't something that I would think of as using the browser for anything.
Maybe it's like embedded browser for help or for content.
Could be something. From what I used of IE9 or the beta, it was fine. I haven't installed the RC, but you know how these things go. It's more of the same, just a little more polished.
Yeah. I think so. There's one killer feature of IE9 RC2 compared to the beta for a web application developer, and that's that there was a bug in the beta where due to transitioning between IPv4 and IPv6 on localhost, it would like drop the page. So what that means in real people, well, or at least developer talk, is when you built an ASP app and hit F5, IE would pop up and say the page can't be displayed. And then you'd refresh the page and it would work.
So it was trying to connect over IPv6 first?
Yeah.
But the web server wasn't
responding. Using it, yeah.
With an IP. Now, if you were on, if you had an IPv6 address, would it work?
I don't know. But I don't even know if the Cassini would respond over IPv6. You know what I mean?
Well, it should. Well, I'm going to say that, but I don't know.
You're just going to say that.
Yeah, because it's going to...
Not knowing whether that's in any way true or not.
Yeah, I mean, it could be hard-coded to just, you know, grab whatever the IPv4 IP is and bind to that, but...
Yeah, well...
I do know that... If you have an IPv6 and an IPv4 address on your computer and you try to connect to an IPv6 site that has links in it to other websites, say it's pulling down JavaScripts or images from other sites that are IPv4 only, the browser is smart enough or the network subsystem is smart enough to go grab the stuff that requires IPv4 over 4 and the stuff that you can do over 6 over 6.
Hmm. But that problem that I originally was mentioning was fixed in the RC, so I was happy about that. Overall, I've been actually pretty – I try and kind of bounce between different browsers. For a long time, I use mostly Firefox. Lately, I've been using Chrome and IE9 mostly. And the UI for IE9 is very Chrome-like, and the overall kind of feel is more Chrome-like. It's very stripped down. A lot of the features that were added for IE7 and IE8 that were kind of like interesting little doodads, but you know, like for instance, web slices or suggested sites or things like that.
Accelerators.
All that stuff is either de-emphasized or not visible. Yeah.
I might have tried it down.
Yeah, it's actually, I mean, it's very, very, you know, slim and fast. And so I guess the frustrations I run into with it, there are a few things that are kind of hand-holding safety things, which I guess I could turn off. Like, for instance, if I download an installer off of SourceForge, it pops up a dialogue that's like, this is not a commonly downloaded or program. Do you want, what do you want to do? And the options are delete or don't run. and then there's over on the left, there's a small advanced drop down, and you click that and it says run this file, and it has like a red X next to it.
Wow.
So I mean, they're like, you know, it has got to be the user's fault if they, you know, you know, and I'm sure that's turn offable, but it's not something I've bothered to turn off. There's a few little UI things. I wish it was a little tighter, like the address bar at the top is blank. I mean, the title bar at the top of the screen is blank. So, like, for such an space-efficient UI, there's just this big quarter inch at the top of my screen that's just blank.
They did make that change in the RC, right, where you could have the tab, the row of tabs underneath the the address bar.
Yep.
That's major to me.
You know, it's cool, and I thought that I would use it and I would switch to that, but I switched to it and I switched back for two reasons. One, that big wasted space up at the top of the screen is already pushing the tabs low enough that it's just like I don't want to waste any more space at the top of the screen. And the other is that I'm not sure exactly what's different, but something about the way that it's handling the tabs, I'm able to fit, I don't know how many I've got now, 30 some tabs across the top, and I can generally see them and have the address bar there. So they seem to like compact. It seems like the original beta was built under the idea that nobody is ever going to use more than like four tabs. And this one, they got a lot of feedback saying, no, we actually do want a lot of tabs. And the reason that your telemetry data says users don't use a lot of tabs is because it's painful in IE. So I guess one other feature or one other thing that I run into with IE9 is that there's still a decent number of sites that where JavaScript breaks. And I still have yet to, find one where it was actually IE9's fault. Like, it's always that there's JavaScript that says, if browser equals IE, then blah, blah, blah. And so you...
Then insert hacky workaround for IE
exactly.
7 and 8.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you can get around...
And does compatibility mode fix that?
Yeah. Generally? Yes, it does. Okay. So, you know, I've gotten pretty used to switching into compatibility mode. I mean, for everything. Hootsuite is one that really bugged me. Like, it just doesn't... It's just completely confused by... you know, by IE9, but then you switch to like IE7 compatibility mode and it's fine, you know, so.
So there was we should probably mention the Mozilla Evangelist post about whether or not IE9 is a modern web browser or not, which was kind of a mean-spirited post, but not entirely undeserved by IE9, I think. He didn't make up facts, but the way that the two sides interpret them are very different. So IE9 passes all of the HTML5 tests that the IE9 team made and submitted to the W3C. And their argument is that, hey, these things are actual standards. And all the other stuff that Firefox and Chrome and everyone supports, they're still in the recommendation stage, you know, they're not finalized and they're you know, kind of buggy. There's problems with them. And we don't want to ship stuff that, you know, isn't complete. And I think that's partially because they know that deep down, they won't be able to push out updates as quick as Firefox or the Chrome team will. So if they ship out something and it turns out there's a hole in web workers where, you know, something, it doesn't work, or worse, there's a security hole, then they're screwed for like, you know, 6 months, unless they, you know, just work around the clock and do a death march to try to get a hot fix out. But on the other hand, that, you know, I do think that browsers need to have that kind of experimental stuff in there, so that, you know, we can kind of move the web forward and see how it all works. And I think they provided plugins for things like WebSockets that you can install in IE9 from their, I can't remember the URL now. John, do you know it? Or Kevin?
It's,
or Case Stat, the HTML5 labs.
Interoperabilitybridges.com.
Of course.
Yeah. Rolls off the tongue. They have ones for, and I think you, if you just search for HTML5 labs, you'll get to it.
Yeah.
But and so they have IndexedDB and they have WebSockets.
Yeah. And so, I mean, some of the stuff in there, like not supporting some of the CSS3 transitions and things like that, really do kind of, you know, it sucks that IE9 doesn't support these things. It's kind of like they're catching up to where Chrome was 2 years ago. In terms of, you know, well, maybe not even two, a year ago, in terms of rounded corners and stuff like that. Some of the HTML5 form tags and form support, I think, is lacking in IE9 as well. Or maybe not lacking, but isn't the same as the support in Chrome and Firefox 4, which is kind of disappointing because that's kind of important. When I think of HTML5, I tend to think in terms of the elements and stuff more than I think of ES5 or
web workers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's me. But so what do you guys think about IE9? Modern web browser? Yes? No? Good start?
Or I think they should partner with Nokia on a browser and then move forward.
Who was it? Was it Nokia that was going to be using WebKit on their phones? I know BlackBerry was.
Everybody's using WebKit except for Microsoft. Yeah. Well, and Firefox. I've got Gecko.
That's true. So far.
Oh, and of course Opera. You forgot Opera.
Sad trombone.
Which actually, so there's a Wikipedia article, comparison of layout engines for HTML5. And it's interesting, you know, like you were mentioning the elements. And I think that's the place I look at, because I think a lot of these features are nice, but you know, like you're saying, form elements and, you know, audio tag. And for me, of course, inline SVG and stuff like that. Those are things that are important. And so Presto seems to do better on most of these, which is Opera. But none of them are complete. And so I think that a lot of them, you know, it's like, who's the best HTML5 browser is a little hard to say, because there's a whole, like, the guys that write the spec aren't committing to anything being released before 2014. And so a lot of it's just kind of like HTML5 is whatever the browser vendors implement. And I guess one thing that's been out there for a while is Acid 3. So I don't know. It's hard. And then there's another website, I guess. Can I use it? Or can I
use? Yeah, can I use it? There's HTML5 score, I think. And then there's can I use... what is it, .com, I think.
Yeah.
Or get that wrong. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here that's kind of annoying that they don't support.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, not supporting async on the script element, kind of a big deal in terms of, you know, optimizing your page loads.
Yeah. You know, I think that my feel on IE9 is it's a big, like, I'm overall pretty happy with it, just mostly because it's in terms of standard support and just kind of focusing on the basics and not wasting time with annoying features. Like I'm happy with the progress made there. There's definitely features that I wish were there. There's a few things, you know, just like SVG fonts and things like that, which are reasons why IE9 release is not supposed to get to 100% on Acid 3, is because they said, well, we don't think SVG fonts are important. And you know, personally, I feel like, well, with all the other browsers at, you know, at 100%, like, you just kind of, it sounds a little lame to say, well, we don't think it's an important feature, so we're not doing it. But
as far as I'm concerned, IE9's job right now is to advance the state of the least common denominator. I mean, that's kind of all I hope for out of Microsoft these days.
Ouch.
And from that regard, I think they've done, you know, a decent job. But Microsoft's problem in the web browser space is, and looks like it's going to continue to be, their inability to iterate quickly. They just can't release this thing fast enough to keep up with the, you know, the web. And I just don't see that changing.
Oh my God, it's even worse than I thought. Like, they don't have support for input types of URL, email, date, time, date, month, number, range.
Oh, that's all jQuery anyhow.
Oh my God. Yeah.
You know, I didn't, it was kind of annoying to me at first, but I've come to realize that one of the most brilliant things that the Chrome team did is have Chrome be auto-updating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it reboots. You know, if you restart it, it will download whatever update is the current, you know, is out there in your whatever family, you know, whether you're on beta or whatever.
Do you think that's something that corporations would go nuts about?
Well, yeah, that's will always be Microsoft's backward compatibility, you know, nightmare, is that they break things in corporations. But that's why they're so far behind in the web. You know, at some point I think they need to do is start fresh, cut themselves loose of the IE legacy.
Well, people have been suggesting that. They've been saying they should, you know, go with WebKit and come out with a consumer browser and then have the enterprise IE, maybe, you know, that is updated differently and doesn't update as often, has different kind of security restrictions and stuff like that.
Hmm.
I don't know. I think yeah, someone needs to skunk works out a browser. I don't know if it needs to be necessarily based on WebKit from Microsoft, but
You know, one thing
that kind of bugs me about IE9 is they really, in my opinion, overemphasize this whole GPU acceleration thing. You know, like that, they hit that one so hard, and it has sort of the feel of and you know, maybe I'm wrong about this. I don't know. You guys can give me your opinion, but it has sort of the feel of the web slices thing. It's like the gee whiz feature that they added that nobody really asked for. And yeah, they come up with some cool demos where it gets used, but I'm not convinced that is going to be like the high impact improvement. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think
it's like every feature list in IE9, like one of the top things is always GPU acceleration.
Yeah.
It's like, whoop-de-doo, is that really going to help me with my Gmail, you know?
I think, Kevin, from what you're saying, that that does ring a little true to me. Like, it seems like it's it's like latching onto, what's HTML5 about? It's about fast, immersive, interactive apps. Okay, GPU is going to do that. You know, and then also like it's like, well, Windows has, you know, some features that allow for, you know, like we've got DirectX, we've got DirectWrite, we've got, you know, all these features. So let's turn them on for IE. And since, you know, maybe it's kind of like leveraging what's available to make it really fast.
Well, it was kind of funny. The point that Kelly Summers made was that IE is actually more GPU accelerated than Silverlight or WPF. So I think that when Canvas was first announced, that a lot of people were envisioning like Quake in the browser kind of thing.
Yeah.
Natively. And I think that's kind of what everyone thinks is going to happen, that they're going to be writing these, you know, we're going to be playing lots of, you know, video, or we're going to be doing lots of animations that need to be fast. And so everyone wanted to get the GPU acceleration as soon as possible with Canvas. And I think that what might end up happening is that people who are writing games in the browsers like that will still use Flash or Silverlight, or if they want to limit their market down, maybe they'll use WebGL. But I'm looking at the Canvas thing and I'm seeing the standard kind of, you know, draw from point to point. And I'm trying to imagine writing a game engine around that, like a 3D accelerated game engine around that. You kind of have to, you know, start from scratch.
Yeah. Well, there'll just be a jQuery plugin. The game jQuery plugin.
There already is. jQuery.game. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that they're going to be doing it either in Flash or Silverlight, because that's what we're doing now. Or they'll do it in WebGL, because they can use kind of standard OpenGL kind of interfaces, I think.
Hmm. Well, and also, you know, as far as modeling tools and the standard game development workflow, you know, I think it's probably easier.
Yeah, there's no way to, you know, there's zero tooling out there for loading a model into Canvas from like Maya or anything else. So it's going to be, you know, interesting to see, you know, what's going to happen. That's why I think that maybe Microsoft has a different target than the web for this GPU acceleration stuff, but it was very important that they get it in there. I don't know what that is, but maybe they're hoping to get it on the phone. And, you know, that's why they wanted to have that kind of support in there.
Well, and then that was announced that it was going to be on the Windows Phone later this year, was going, instead of this kind of IE7-ish browser that's on Windows Phone, that it was going to be running IE9. So
that's certainly a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And yeah, that, I guess that would make some sense, you know, where it's like that is more important on the phone if people are going to be using HTML apps. And
well, which makes the HTML5 support even more important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if you're using a input type 8 or input type, you know, number in a web app, you know, you're going to have a certain interface that comes up. But when you're using it on the phone, there are standard kind of controls for entering dates, like on iPhone. So, you know, if you put an input type equals date, it brings up the little scrolling date picker when you select it in a web app in iPhone or in iOS.
Yeah.
So will that happen in IE9? Well, IE9 didn't look like it supports input type date. So you're going to be back to using the keyboard to input your date.
Hmm. Yeah. So,
but it will be GPU accelerated keyboard, I guess.
So one place that it's not supported is on Windows XP. And I know that that's got some people going nuts, saying, you know, this is terrible, because in terms of what you were saying, Kevin, that the IE, you know, the progress of IE pushes forward the overall, you know, baseline support for the internet. So if we've got people frozen forever at IE8, because they just refuse to give up XP, or because they're, you know, corporate whatever apps won't run on Vista or whatever, you know, anything greater than XP. I don't know. What do you guys think about that? I wonder, like, is this whole XP thing just eventually these computers are going to wear out and people are going to buy new computers and you know, like people are going to lose their XP disks and.
Well, eventually they'll just upgrade to Vista.
Right.
I mean, I certainly know plenty of companies that are on XP and have no plans to upgrade in the near future. So, I mean, it is. But those companies also will probably not upgrade to IE9 anyway. So,
yeah.
They're still. These are the companies that still run IE6 because all their internal applications require IE6.
Mm-hmm.
This, by the way, to me, is the thing that Microsoft could most do to free us from the IE6 legacy. Would be to release a standalone IE6 browser that these companies could use and then upgrade their primary browser to IE9.
Yeah.
This is like a total no-brainer to me.
But then they'd have to admit that they could run IE separate.
Yeah. I remember we were, Scott Kuhn, you and I, we would always be on the IE chats and we'd say like, can you please do this? And it was always like, no, we cannot happen because it was like,
can we have a managed add-in system?
Well, that too, but
still no.
Yeah. Yeah. But that IE was, you know, the networking stack is built deep into Windows. And so you can't separate out the different versions.
Right, except that some companies already have,
yeah.
like Spoon, and they're apparently, by the way, are gonna be announcing something at the beginning of March. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Yeah, I did.
And then somebody else had that too. There was an app that could host multiple versions of IE.
Yeah,
what's it called?
It was from My Debug Bar, and it was like IE Tester.
Super Preview.
Well, so the problem with Super Preview is that it will let you view the site, but it's not interactive. You know what I mean?
Right. So, in this day and age, makes it kind of worthless.
Yeah, it's a screenshot tool. So.
Well, it used to let you interact. It just didn't support, you know, authentication or cookies or anything useful.
I didn't think so. Maybe I'm wrong.
Because I remember during the beta, I logged a bug on Connect, which was, of course, marked won't fix, because I was trying to use... I think I was trying to use basic auth. I was trying to use some kind of auth to log into the site, and it wouldn't let me log in. So I couldn't actually preview the site in Super Preview.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't log in.
Should we call it quits?
I think we've exhausted all possibilities. Unless we want to talk more about cart space.
Yes. You see, it's brilliant. It's claims-based tokens are... signified and authenticated in a global meat space conservatorium of brilliance.
Excellent.
See, if they'd called it meat space, it would have been a winner.
Yeah. I agree.
All right, that's all the time we have this week, and certainly more than we have to talk about this week. So we'll catch you on the next show of Herding Code. Hooray!
Super card space.